Net-a-Porter presents The Incredible Women Podcast, Series 8, The Powerhouses.
Welcome to Series 8 of The Incredible Women Podcast, in partnership with De Beers, in which we sit down with women who are leading the charge in their industries, those who are admired for their unique talent, strength, drive and influence. All at the top of their game, some of these incredible women you'll already be familiar with, and others we're excited to introduce you to. I'm Alice Casely-Hayford, Content Director at Net-a-Porter, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined for this episode of our Powerhouse series by award-winning writer, director, and filmmaker, Lulu Wang.
I really started thinking about what is my role in this. Like, I am an artist, I have a platform, you know, and I have the right to claim that. And I have to find a way to use my work to say something. And what is that? And so it's something I'm still navigating through.
Wang was born in Beijing in 1983 before emigrating to Miami with her family when she was 6 years old. Wang studied music and literature at Boston College from 2001 and graduated in 2005 with a double major in literature and music. Inspired to become a filmmaker after watching Steven Sheinberg's 2002 film Secretary in her senior year, Wang then took two film production courses and made several short films while still at college. After learning the art of film and producing a few short student films and documentaries, Wang moved to Hollywood in 2007 to pursue her dream. Her semi-autobiographical film The Farewell in 2019 won numerous awards and was nominated for a Golden Globe and BAFTA. And then earlier this year, her latest project, a TV adaptation of the best-selling novel The Expatriates, hit screens, starring and produced by Nicole Kidman. Let's meet Lulu. Hello, Lulu. Welcome. It is such a pleasure to be chatting with you today. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's really nice to talk to you too.
Great. Well, this series of our podcast is called The Powerhouses, which of course you are. What does power mean to you?
I think that it's a question I don't know that I have an answer for, but it's something that I think about a lot, and how and who gets to wield power and the way that power looks in our society tends to be a very male kind of power that involves perhaps volume, perhaps taking up space. It involves control. And it's just not how I want to function in my day-to-day life. And so I'm trying to redefine power in my life, and when I have it, or when I feel powerless and I want more power, what is that about? You know, interrogating that. And it's this balance of, you know, it's important for us to take up space. I think sometimes, I'll speak for myself, I have the opposite problem where I don't want to take up too much space. I'm afraid I'm taking up too much space. I think that the ways that I'm thinking about power now is actually, how can I channel power to slow down, right? Because there's so much power in being quiet. Being quiet in a room is also a way of taking up space, of letting the silence sit as you think about an answer before you speak. In treading softly, I think vulnerability is power. The power to say, it's okay, I'm going to admit to what my process was, and I'm open to whatever people want to say, and I'm open to sharing the ways in which I critique myself, because in that way, you can't hurt me. I have no shame. I'm good. I'm okay. Like, that to me is power in a very different way than we're used to seeing it. And I think that mischief can also be incredibly powerful, and being subversive and, you know, navigating systems to create something subversive, to really say something. And so that's something that I'm trying to constantly navigate, you know, subversive art that, yeah, subversive art. when you're trying to say something meaningful, hopefully.
Well, that you definitely are. Well, for someone who hasn't finished their first cup of coffee, that is an incredibly pertinent and powerful answer. So thank you very much. I think it's really interesting what you say about taking up space. And I know as a woman, as a Black woman, I'm often feeling apologetic for taking up space, whereas I think my male counterpart would just, you know, bowl into a room and be all singing, all dancing. And again, as you said, that power in being quiet, that is so potent, but it takes a lot of courage, I think, to sit quietly, because often you just want to fill the silence. You're, of course, a very successful writer, director and filmmaker. Has there been a moment in your career where you thought to yourself, okay, wow, I've made it? Or is this something that you're still working towards?
I think that, you know, any kind of external factor that might have made me feel like I've made it is all false. The real sense of making it is when I am actually able to be very present in a moment where I'm really upset and where I actually say, this is how this is making me feel. Like, that makes me feel like I've made it in a whole nother way. Like, it's not about awards. It's not about just all of the external affirmation, but instead to, as you say, to take up space in a room and to also say no. Like, that to me is the real power, to live in a place of abundance, even if that might not always be true. And for me, it certainly hasn't been. I didn't grow up with wealthy parents. We were immigrants, and we've always struggled when I was young. And so there is this mentality of, like, you take every opportunity that comes to you. And to be able to say, this doesn't feel right, I don't like the dynamic that this is having, and I don't want to spend my time in this space because life is short. So thank you, but no thank you. Like, that is power.
That is. What are your tips on encouraging someone else to be more comfortable or confident to say no? Or, because it's not an easy thing to do. And I guess that must have taken some training or just experience over the years throughout your career to have the confidence to say that.
Yeah, I'm still working on it, quite honestly. So I and every time I have a really big decision and where I feel like I want to say no, but I feel like I'm letting so many people down, it's incredibly difficult to go against that conditioning, to not let people down, to disappoint people, to not be nice and to make everyone feel good. You know, that's something I've struggled with my whole life, is how to find my own path and without it feeling selfish, you know, because ultimately, if you're good with yourself, if you make the choices that feel are in line with your values and make you happy, you're ultimately going to be a better person in the world. You're going to be a more generous person. You're going to be a more kind person because you have more to give. But if you don't build that for yourself, if you are constantly people pleasing, then that's going to chip away at you. And yeah, and so it's, I guess my advice would just be to really talk to yourself about what you want and what you're feeling. And, you know, I try to, this is, you know, a meditation thing, but just try to be in my body and go, okay, what am I feeling? Where am I feeling it? And I journal a lot, you know, and I talk to my friends, you know, a lot of my really close friends are so emotionally intelligent that they'll reflect back to me and say, it sounds to me that this is not something you want to do, you know, and things like that. But it's important to really question it.
Well, that's very interesting as well that you talk about journaling and friends. Some of our previous guests on this podcast, Gloria Steinem and Issa Rae, both said pretty much the same answer in terms of talking circles, community, and journaling. So evidently it's a common theme for our powerhouses, which is amazing to hear. But you touched earlier on awards and kind of the more superficial aspect of Hollywood, I guess. And it was your 2019 film, The Farewell, that was really your breakthrough moment in inverted commas. Were you prepared to the response to The Farewell and being thrust into the spotlight? What was that like for you?
I was very unprepared for that because up until The Farewell came out at Sundance, I had been told it would be a very niche film that because of the choices that I had made of making it, you know, first of all, for making it 75% in Mandarin subtitled, that would limit the audience. The fact that the plot and the casting was 100% Chinese-American, one Japanese actor, that would not be popular or commercial. And so for that to then blow up in the way that it did, for as many people around the world to have seen it and messaged me and to travel around the world and have people in every country say, we did this to my family and you know, we have this tradition too in our culture. And oh my gosh, it moved me so much. And yeah, it kind of just like shifted my whole universe and my whole lens into the world.
But it must have also been a bit of an F you to those who said it couldn't be a commercial success, that it wouldn't resonate globally. It's like, excuse me, it really, really did. So that must have been really rewarding. And also in terms of, as you said, the casting, knowing that that is so necessary and welcome. That's what people want to see on their screens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's of course nice to prove people wrong who are less optimistic, I guess. And it also is just a reminder that you have to follow your instinct and you have to take risks. And look, that might not always work out. It's also a lot to do with luck. You know, the fact that it came out in 2019 as opposed to a later year when there was a pandemic and the festivals were online and all of that comes into play. And we had a wonderful distributor. We really had an incredible team of producers that supported me. So I feel incredibly lucky. But yeah, you have to keep taking risks and it might not always work out. That's like it never stops being scary is the thing. It's not like, great, you were proven right once. That means you're always going to be right. That's not true.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting what you say about luck and things that come up that you can never expect, primarily the pandemic, which happened straight after your film, and then movements like Black Lives Matter, Stop Asian Hate, the strike. There have been so many huge disruptors and massive moments that have affected the industry. What has it been like navigating that as a creator?
I think it made me think a lot about my role in the industry, in the arts. You know, my parents are both in like the social sciences. My mother is a writer. My father is a translator and he used to be a diplomat. So in many ways, I feel like it's in the family. But also because we're Chinese immigrants, they never expected me to be an artist of any kind. They felt like it would be incredibly volatile and unstable. So then, you know, after the success of The Farewell and then all of these events in the world, I really started thinking about what is my role in this. Like, I am an artist. I have a platform, you know, and I have the right to claim that. And I have to find a way to use my work to say something. And what is that? And so it's something I'm still navigating through.
I bet. Well, use your work wisely, you do. And so let's get on to Expats, which is sensational. What was it like being approached to work on something, you know, with massive names already involved, like Nicole Kidman? What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, that was a moment, you know, as far as your earlier question of like, when did you know you made it? Not that I knew I made it, but I was like, wait, Nicole Kidman watched my film about my grandma? Like, there's just some like disparities that are too great to even comprehend. So I was really flattered, but it also felt very surreal and unreal. You know, I think that when things are too high or too low, my mom always says, be careful. You know, when you're being celebrated so, so, so much and everyone says you're great, be careful. In the same way, when everyone says you're horrible and everyone's attacking you and saying you don't know anything, be careful. You know, and so it's about this like really balanced walking one foot in front of the other, being really balanced. And so I was really flattered, but I also felt like, how am I going to walk one foot in front of the other with a project with Nicole Kidman and Amazon? And, you know, it would be a series. It wouldn't just be a 90-minute film. So it felt really daunting, and I really was not sure about doing it.
Wow. Well, won't give any spoilers away, but in terms of putting one foot in front of the other, that feels very relevant to Expats itself. It covers so much and it explores relationships, you know, between parents and children, lovers, both married and extramarital, employers and their home staff. And that's just one part of it. What drew you to the story or stories rather?
Exactly that, the intersection of all of these different people. I just felt like I wanted to tell a story about humanity and the good and the bad, and all of the flaws and all of the beauty and all of the ways that we hurt each other and all of the ways that we try to love each other and sometimes fail. Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, it's a show about empathy. It's a show about disparities. You know, there's a part of me that looks at my life and the path that I've been on. And sometimes I'm in rooms and I'm like, if I put this in a movie, it wouldn't be real. If you look at like where I come from, what my parents and I went through, and then the rooms that I'm in now, the people that I'm with, there's a really sort of it feels alien. And yet I don't want to feel alien in those places. Like, I belong there. I deserve to be there. I've gotten myself there, and I need to acknowledge that and be proud of myself, which is hard for me to even say. But I think that this show was a way to bring all of that together. You know, like all of those worlds, like the world that I come from, the worlds that I'm in now, and show the good and the bad and the just all of the facets.
Well, it's very interesting as well in terms of identity and homegoing and alienness or feeling othered. You've lived in America for a long, long time now. Do you think it won't feel alien to you, or will there be spaces that you feel truly comfortable? Can you explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually feel quite at home now. That's primarily just because I have a family. I have an actual home. I have a garden. I have land. I grow things out of that land and I eat them. And so I feel connected. I have community. I have friends. I have work that is meaningful. So all of that makes me feel rooted in many ways. And yet there's still a part of me that is always searching, I think, but in the way that everyone searches, you know, because the world is changing so fast and we're all trying to keep up. So I think the places I feel more alien are more like industry and glitz and glamour. Like when I have, you know, a dinner party and I have friends over, that feels a lot more sane to me. Like, I'm very drawn to one-on-one conversations, and I'm much more of an observer than I enjoy being observed. And so I think that I'm most in my power when I can lead with my curiosity and get to know people and really talk to them, as opposed to being in spaces where it's just, ah, hi, oh my God, I love you.
fair enough. What was it like, the difference in approach working on TV in comparison to film?
Well, you know, it's basically making 6 films in a row. We didn't change the way we shoot, block, you know, the camera work, like, I brought the same team from the farewell, and we had made a small, you know, indie film before, and now we're applying that to a 6.5-hour series. So the length of it was really huge. I mean, it just took, I think we did like 26 days on the farewell on set, and then this was like well over 100 days on set. And I would just say the scope of it, like being creative for 26 days, not really sleeping, showing up day after day and, you know, fighting to get these shots and get it perfectly and get these performances, you know, doing that for 26 days is one thing, and doing that for the length that we did for the series is another. But it also, you know, was a kind of training. Like, I feel like I'm up for anything now, like I can handle anything. And the scope of this show was so much larger, like the visual effects, the special effects, you know, the kind of set builds that we had to do. So, I'm just incredibly proud of my whole team who really like stepped into this challenge and delivered.
I read that you're not so concerned with people watching expats in sort of numerical order. Why is that?
Well, like any person, how you meet them is going to color how you see them, right? Like when and how you meet that person. And so the show is the same way. Some people might enter through the door of the expats and start with episode one, and then they're going to get a reverse perspective when they get to five. Or many people can start with five, and then the reverse perspective is actually episode one, when they go back to the beginning. So I sort of, it's just a little experiment, I guess. I wanted to challenge different people to watch it differently and then talk about it and talk about how that shaped the way they saw the whole series, whether they started with episode one or whether they started with episode five.
Interesting. Well, unfortunately, I can't go back and unsee it, but I'll be intrigued to watch it at a later date again.
Wait, which one did you see first?
I started with one.
Oh, you did.
But now I wish I maybe hadn't. But I enjoyed it in its order that it was maybe intended to or unintended to be. Speaking of intention, the writer's room for expats was all female. You said that wasn't intentional. How did it shift the dynamic in comparison to projects you've worked on previously where it might have been more male dominated?
I've never worked on anything that's very male dominated. Like, most of my collaborators on set are women, and just worked out that way. I, again, wasn't something that I intentionally set out to do, even if I should have, perhaps, but it just wasn't. But I've never written with anyone else, period. I've always written alone. And when you write alone, you have a lot of, like, your own psychology, your own perspective that you're kind of locked into, and there's no one to challenge you, right? And you just kind of go, oh, well, what if this happens? And what's so great about the writer's room is that there's all these brilliant women who have different perspectives. And so it's what's great was not how similar we were. I mean, it was great that we had a shorthand, we could say certain things, and you never have to go, well, this is why this is interesting to women. Right. There was never that. But what was great was that we actually challenged each other in our differences. You know, I'll name a specific example. In the book, Charlie, who is a love interest of Mercy, is a man, a young man. And one of the writers said, well, why couldn't Charlie be a woman? You know, because she's queer, Vera Miao, she's queer. And she was like, well, why couldn't she be a woman? And it's okay that she's with David and she's now with Charlie. And like, we don't have to define that. And, you know, just those types of ideas that just really open up the possibilities for the story.
But having not written with other people before, did you have to do a bit of shaking it out and letting go? Or did it come quite naturally to collaborate in that way?
It's pretty natural to me, because even when I write alone, I share my work with people that I trust. And I think that because I grew up in the household that I did, where I was criticized a lot by my parents, they think it makes you stronger, I guess, you know. I think I was trained to have a mechanism to still listen, like to not just like repel criticism in general and to take it with a grain of salt. You know, that's something that I'm working on. It's like, okay, where are you coming from? I don't agree with this, but I do agree with that. Or let's talk about this. You know, we don't agree, but let's talk about this. So, you know, my dad is, again, a translator, interpreter, a diplomat. And so, and when you're in between cultures, like you spend your life doing that. You spend your life negotiating between languages, cultures, people. So in a way, it was really natural for me to have a writer's room.
You mentioned there about your parents being quite harsh critics. Are you grateful for that now in hindsight, or was it tough as a child and teenager?
It was definitely tough. I don't know if I'm grateful. It just is what it is. I mean, it also comes with the other side where maybe I'm too open to criticism sometimes, and sometimes I'm too hard on myself, and that's led to a lot of stress and anxiety that's really unnecessary. So I'm actually trying to move into a space where I'm more confident and where I can let things fall, like, you know, and not take everything and everyone so seriously. But it, you know, what do they call it, grit? That definitely helped me to have some grit. And I don't, without it, I don't think that I would have made it in this industry, because you have to just keep pushing and keep pushing in the face of so much opposition.
Totally. Well, it can't have also been too off-putting, because I hear you're collaborating with them both, your mother on a book and your father on an autobiographical podcast, I believe. I don't want to probe you to give too much away, but can you tell us a little bit more about these projects?
Yeah, well, they're very early stages. They're just ways in which I want to capture their stories. I want to give them voice to their own stories, especially because they always claim I misrepresent them. I'm like, well, then you tell your own stories. It's a way just for me to capture it before it's too late.
Mm. Well, that sounds beautiful. But speaking of family, if you don't mind me asking, what is it like being half of one of Hollywood's new powerhouse couples?
Well, we're pretty goofy. I think people don't necessarily know that about Barry either. I mean, I've made a comedy, but I think people think of us as being quite serious, and that couldn't be further from the truth. And we don't really like to think about power or powerhouse. It's really nice at the end of the day to be able to go home to somebody and talk about what you've been through and what you're going through, and have them understand, have them give you advice, because I think there's so much of it that's not about the creative work itself, but just about navigating the politics, the industry, and the emotions around all of that. And, you know, what should I do next? And what's the right thing? Is, you know, all of it, right? And so that's incredibly helpful. And what I love about Barry, too, is that he believes in supporting younger generations, and really he talks about being an amateur and wanting to stay an amateur. And I love that, because that's how I feel. I want to stay a student always and to keep learning. And by doing labs and, you know, mentoring young filmmakers, it helps me to keep learning as well.
Well, it's very funny. I interviewed your partner, Barry Jenkins, pretty much 3 years ago exactly. And I was 6 months pregnant then, and I'm 6 months pregnant now. So it feels like history's repeating itself. Wow. But it's really wonderful to hear such parallels between your answers as well, because he said such similar things in terms of being able to share this experience with someone on the inside who gets it. And it's not necessarily about sitting down and looking at a script together, but more just talking about, you know, being on the inside and what that's like for you both, and also how important it is to you to support the next generations. How do you make time for that mentoring? And is it something that you really carve out, or it's just something that you happens to be a part of every day?
Well, we do labs every year. You know, there's a couple that I try to commit to every single year. And as new opportunities come up, I just look to, you know, to see how my year shakes out. But, you know, one of the things that Barry does too, more than me, it's weird because I think that I'm less shy. I'm more outgoing in certain situations, but then he's more outgoing in other situations. We'll be at a restaurant and somebody will come up and be like, "I'm such a huge fan." He's like, "Are you a filmmaker? Give me your email." Yeah, like, da, da, da. I'm like, you know, and like, he's just not afraid to do that. And he'll reach out to people on social media and say, "Yeah, you know what? I heard about your short film. Let me watch it." And so whether it's just day to day, you know, being open to hearing from young people and new filmmakers, or it's setting intentional time to do these labs.
Amazing. Well, I actually just have one final question for you today, and it sort of relates to that last one in terms of the people exciting you and what you want to see next in the industry. But who are the incredible women that are inspiring you most for 2024?
Okay, I have so many, but I'll start with Greta Lee. I really, really loved her performance in Past Lives. And I think that, you know, I have such respect for people who, women particularly, who have been working in this industry for a long time and fighting to have their voice in it and have their place in it. And Greta has such incredible vision and in front of the camera and behind the camera. And so I'm just really excited that so many great things are happening for her. I have to also say that someone that inspires me a lot is an actor who is in Expats, one of our stars, Saryu Blue. I might be biased because we've become good friends, but not only is she great in the show, and I'm not just saying that to, you know, to promote it, but she's
phenomenal.
Phenomenal, but she's also just an incredible person who, again, has been in this industry as long as Nicole Kidman, as long as so many stars who have had the chance to do all kinds of work. And Saryu has never been given an opportunity to do what she does in this show. And that breaks my heart. It makes me excited that she finally gets to see to do it. But it also breaks my heart because how many other actors are not given that opportunity to show what they can do, to show the range, because the roles aren't there for them. And it's not because of the limitations of their own capability. And so just thinking about that propels me forward to keep writing roles for people who don't get these opportunities.
Totally. Well, thank goodness for you and for creating that space for others and making these platforms so that we can see such varied and amazing talent and hear such beautiful stories. Lulu, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much for the wonderful chat.
The Powerhouses was brought to you by Net-a-Porter and Chalk and Blade, hosted by Net-a-Porter's content director Alice Casely-Hayford and fashion director Kay Barron. The team at Net-a-Porter was Katie Berrington as the senior editor, with casting by Annabelle Brog and Olivia Wakefield, and coordination by Gabriella Pereira. The producer at Chalk and Blade was Laura Hyde, with help from Emily Wally. Original music by Alexis Adamora, and the series was mixed by Nasson De Silva. To make sure you hear all the episodes in this series, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, go to net-a-porter.com.